The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order Tuesday, April 21st. We have 55 minutes to meet today. And the first item on the agenda is to tell you that the first item on the agenda is having a 3 o'clock meeting. The ASH Boar Disease Epidemic Crisis Conflict, whatever, is having a summit, a big meeting with big people in it. Well, maybe not so big, but their brains are big. And they are going to talk about how the state is going to address this, or how they're going to recommend that the state address this issue, problem, crisis. Who knows? And we probably will have this on our agenda then tomorrow morning at 8:30 when we meet for a short time to find out about this. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there's a big meeting at 3 o'clock on Emerald Ash Borer, how come Representative Loeffler, who's been working on this for many years, and Representative Davids, who's right next to the infestation, how come they're here and not at that meeting to discuss Emerald Ash Borer?
I imagine it's because they didn't want to ask to be excused for the invitation that they must have received.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
What I would have said had I been invited, was that I'm not missing Chair Murphy's committee.
See, that's what was my first. That was my first intuition. And Representative Loeffler.
And Madam Chair, I don't think we should ignore the role of our cities, counties, and townships who are wondering about their responsibilities. And I see Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities is here. So obviously the local government role may not be on the agenda as well. Maybe they're just getting organized within the administration.
Maybe this was a pre-meeting. I don't know. But I didn't have anything to do with it. But I want to know what the recommendations are going to be and how it's going to be addressed statewide. And I think that by tomorrow, I have been assured by someone that's going to hurry out and go to that meeting that they will be ready for a report for tomorrow. Is that right, Ms. Cheney? And we're also going to have Representative Junkie still before us tomorrow, too. Whether we have received it or not, we're going to hear what's contained therein. Ms. Cheney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Quinn Cheney, Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And yes, as you have referenced, there are a number of meetings going on today with neighboring states and with the federal government and with within the administration with multiple agencies. And we are trying to, in the process of finalizing our ICS structure, which stands for Internal Command Service. No, I'm not sure what it stands for. ICS. Structure that will encompass multiple agencies in neighboring states and federal government, and we would like to brief you on that tomorrow. We're just trying to finalize that up today, and we will be happy to talk to you about that in great detail tomorrow morning.
Good. At 8:30.
At 8:30.
Okay.
And I believe we will have Joe Martin here from the Department of Agriculture and someone from the Department of Natural Resources as well to talk about how the agencies are working together.
Very good. And Representative Loeffler, do you have a bill on this?
Madam Chair, I have a bill that was in before it was discovered. And it's the Forest Protection Task Force, which we directed in laws, recommendations. It was presented to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council before the outbreak was determined to be right on our doorstep, and I would be delighted to share that report. It was heard in the Environment Finance Committee, and they held it over simply because they wanted to hear from the administration on their recommendations, and it was new enough that we felt like we needed to gather some additional information.
And so that bill will be in our packets tomorrow, and we can address that too.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I also have a House file. A bill that's been introduced regarding, it's not as extensive statewide as Representative Loeffler's. It's more specific to the southeast corner. So that bill is out there also.
Good. And Mr. Chen will get the number of that bill too, and that will be in our packets tomorrow. Thank you, Ms. Cheney.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The second item on our agenda today is to go back and have some answers to some questions that we have on the clean water and the parks and trails and maybe even the outdoor heritage bills that we had earlier this week. And Commissioner, could you come down?
That's coming.
Perhaps you're not the one, but I know that you have people with you that can answer the questions. But could we have some more background on that Mississippi River Corridor issue that arose yesterday? And
Madam Chair, yes. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Kent Lockesmore, Director of the Division of Waters here, who can help address some of the questions I believe that arise from the Mississippi River critical area legislation that is in the clean water bill. So without any further ado,
and
Mr. Lockesmore.
And we're talking about the Mississippi River going all the way from Itasca all the way through Minnesota, aren't we? We're not talking just about Mississippi River that's just north of St. Paul or Minneapolis, are we?
Madam Chair, for the record, Kent Lockesmore, Director of Division of Waters. No, in this, for the critical area discussion that we've had, and I didn't hear the discussion yesterday, but we are only talking about the stretch through essentially the metropolitan area,
okay.
The 77 miles, or 72 miles.
But 72 miles, it's a lot more than one city.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me,
it's
Madam Chair?
Not more than one or two little cities. It's
Yes, Madam Chair. It's, I believe, 31 communities and then parts of a couple counties for the unincorporated areas.
Okay. And in the proposed rules, Mr. Lockesmore, do you have that people can't rebuild their house or if they have a fire or their land can't be used in certain ways?
Madam Chair, no, not yet. I mean, we don't have a draft rule yet. I mean, what this legislation does is directs us to take requirements out of the Critical Area Act, which was done under an executive order, and promulgate those into rules along with, and we'd have an inclusive process using or involving advisory groups and the local units of government. As far as nonconformities, there's existing statutory language for the counties in 394 and for the cities in Chapter 462 that deal with nonconformities already. And basically what that language says is if you have a nonconforming structure that is destroyed, you can replace it at the same dimension as long as you apply within 180 days. That's existing law.
Oh. That might be something. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Mr. Lockesmore, there's nothing in House File 1973 that changes that. There's no statutory change to that statute, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, that is correct.
And it wouldn't be your intention to go into that part of the law?
Madam Chair.
Through your new rulemaking?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was a little slow on my note-taking. Could you tell me what sections of law this is currently in on this non-conforming language?
It's Chapter 462 for counties. I think it's 462.36. Then for cities, it's Chapter 394. And I don't recall the exact citation, but I could find it if you need that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was that the issue that a counselor from Anoka
yes.
was talking about? So, Madam Chair, what was he talking about?
Well, he was talking about DNR. Promulgating rules.
Madam Chair, he talked as if, though, the DNR is going to change Western civilization as we today know it. On this issue. So, what was he talking about?
I think he was saying that they have their rules, they have their local ordinances, and local ordinances know it almost as much about what is needed as the DNR, but the local people's wants should be placed at least equally with what's needed.
Thank you for clearing that
up.
But
I may be misinterpreting what they were saying, but I wish, I hope that if we have questions about the rulemaking process or about what might happen to local ordinances, they should be brought out now. And when you make rules, do you look at local ordinances before you make your suggestions of how they should be changed? Do you start out with the local ordinances, or do you start out with this is the way it should be, and then look at the local ordinances after that?
Madam Chair, we often, like in the shoreline rule process that we're undertaking now, there's an existing set of rules. So you start with that as a basis, and you look at things that, or as experience has dictated, should be changed. And here you have an executive order that sets some standards, and there are local governments have adopted ordinances and controls, and we're going to be looking at all of those as we move from an executive order to rules. And we would involve the cities and local citizens and other interested groups in the process as we develop these rules. And it's a Chapter 14 hearing process. Eventually it goes to an administrative law judge. But, we would propose through the process that you work out most of those issues before you get before an administrative law judge. So I would expect that we would have, whether or not this new set of rules is going to be more strict or less strict than the standard that exists now, I don't know yet. I mean, we're going to go through an open, transparent process and develop a set of rules. And one thing that a set of rules does is it provides a little more clarity than what you have in an executive order as this section of river is administered now. So it would provide some more certainty to on all sides of the issue, but it's premature to say whether what it's actually going to be in a final rule.
And why did we get this executive order, Mr. Laxmore?
Madam Chair, this executive order came about in the late 70s due to the threat on the St. Croix River, primarily, with the Allen S. King plant being proposed, And that section of river was first designated as critical area and then later designated as a National Wild and Scenic River. So it was a step back in the late 70s to protect the St. Croix River. And the L&S King plant was obviously still built, but that was seen as the impetus towards designating that as a critical area, and then later the Mississippi River through the metro area here as a critical area.
And in the rulemaking process, you said groups and communities and city councils and county board members and homeowners are able to participate in the process?
Madam Chair, yes. You know, several weeks ago we talked with, I think it was the city of Brooklyn Park, they had concerns. And while we don't have a list of all the landowners along the critical area, we would have a listserv. We'd have a website set up. So if people can provide or cities provide us a list of names to get notification of the process, we would do that electronically or by paper if that was their only means. But we aren't going to go out searching for individuals. We would hope that would come through a local process, through the local municipalities or other local environmental groups or other interested parties.
How long does rulemaking usually take?
Madam Chair, probably about 2 years. I mean, you're going to take a year or so to develop the actual rule, and then the formal process, once you get into the notice requirements and the administrative law judge process, that could take about another year.
Any other questions? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While there are many times when people in my district are opposed to some of the DNR rule process, in the end, after all the angst and the steam and the smoke and the anger, it really does, in the end, turn out rather well. And in my district, if you want to have a town hall meeting, just mention a little teeny clip on the radio or in the newspaper that the DNR is going to have a hearing on rules and they want to take away fill in the blank. You'll get hundreds of people there, for good or bad, but I think it's a process that is very difficult for them. It's very difficult for the administrative law judge. I mean, I've been to many of these processes, and I would say 90% finish the way you started, and 10% come to us, and we change the rule or something to that. 10%, I would think, maybe, that we disagree and we change it. So I think they do a pretty good job overall.
Any other questions? Representative Lauper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Locasmo, I can't remember for sure if it was last year or the year before, but we created in Minneapolis a joint Mississippi River planning organization to involve all, I think there was 11 entities that have input and control along the Mississippi River, from the Heritage Preservation Commission for the riverfront area in downtown, to watershed districts, to the U of M, which has a significant amount of waterfront and is planning for it, along with the city and the county and a variety of interests. And it sounds like you're trying to do exactly the same thing, only for the whole metro area. What's the role of this group in providing input and guidance? Are they the same as just a member of the public? Are you going to delegate to them an expectation that they come up with the first draft and you make sure it fits in with the other provisions of the plan? Could you expand upon that a little bit?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't think that we would, I mean, we haven't formulated exactly how we're going to develop this rule. I don't believe, though, we would delegate the drafting responsibilities for a first cut to any one group. That's probably, and oftentimes it helps to have a rough draft so people can react to it instead of just a blank sheet of paper as you're talking about rules. So I would expect that we would have some introductory meetings and talk about the concepts that people wish to include in this rule, and then we would put something on paper for people to react to. But this group, you know, certainly would be involved, and whether or not they wish to be involved collectively as a group or not, it's difficult right now with the way, you know, whose input is, you know, things like it's all input we would consider, and there's not one that's more important than another at this point.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Locuslam, I mean, this is a very important decision for people who care about this wonderful, unique natural resource. And you won't be able to start with a clean slate of paper, I hope, because I hope before you can even take that piece of paper and put it in your printer, you'll have spent some time actually reviewing all the plans and all the input and the partnership efforts that have already been begun. And that doesn't mean you can't be open to new ideas and new input and reconsideration, but I think the citizens have a lack of patience, quite honestly, when we keep redoing the same thing over and over again, especially when there's things that are trying to coordinate everyone together. And so I'm hoping that as a starting point, you'll look at that. I'm not saying I would bless every piece of those plans. There's some visions in my city that I don't particularly cherish as much as other people might, like the continued use of industrial property along the river. But I do think that they need to at least be acknowledged as you go forward.
Mr. Locksmith.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lupp, we did do a report last year that included, looked at the entire application of the critical area plan. And that the report is what prompted this legislation by Representative Hansen and the others. So we certainly will be looking at that and looking at what communities have adopted, what they have for existing ordinances, and whether or not there are pitfalls or problem areas within their ordinances or the application of the critical area that should be strengthened or adjusted as we move forward.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Locke, as well as one of the components of the bill talks about drinking water, and I just wanted to confirm that drinking water intakes are from the Mississippi River in the critical area. Is that correct?
That's correct. Both the intakes for, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, for both Minneapolis and St. Paul are in the Mississippi River in Fridley.
That's part of the 72 miles?
Within the 72-mile corridor, Madam Chair.
And are any of the other communities, the 31 communities, getting water out of Mississippi too for drinking?
Madam Chair, the other communities predominantly are groundwater, although some of the first-ring suburbs buy water from the Minneapolis or St. Paul. So Richfield, Bloomington, some of the St. Paul suburbs are buying water from the St. Paul system. So that is predominantly surface water.
So indeed this rulemaking is appropriate to a fund that's going to deal with drinking water and clean water.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that's the decision the committee needs to make.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. Will the rules that once established, will they be enforceable to areas of townships and cities and large cities at the same rate, or will large cities be overruling your rules?
Madam Chair, Representative Paz, I would expect that we would have rules that would require local governments to adopt an ordinance. And typically what we've done in the other programs for shoreland and the other land use programs, shoreland and floodplain management, the state has minimum standards and local government can be more restrictive, but they can't be less restrictive.
The larger cities then would be governed by this, although they would be enforcing it themselves?
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Paz. Yes, the local municipalities or local governmental units for townships or counties would be administering this set of standards, as they do now under the critical area.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. The smaller cities and the townships, aren't they enforced by the state and the larger city by the city?
Madam Chair, Representative Hogg, no. The local governments administer their own zoning controls. The state does not make zoning decisions. We have oversight over those decisions.
Madam Chair, even for the river rules?
Madam Chair, Representative Hogg, do you mean for the St. Croix River rules or the... or? Which river rules? We have a set of wild and scenic river rules.
I'll try wild and scenic river rules. Isn't that enforced by the state and then enforced by the city, Madam Chair?
And Madam Chair, for wild and scenic rivers, the local government makes a zoning decision, but the state has certification authority over that decision. So we have essentially, if you will, veto power. So we have to certify whether or not the local government followed the rule. So we have a role in those decisions. In shoreline management, for example, we don't have that role. Where local government makes a decision, and if we feel they've stepped over the bounds too far, we would have to sue them in district court.
Madam Chair, one last follow-up.
Representative House.
If then the city, small city, township, or large city gets to make the rules and you say whether you like them or not, isn't the rules inconsistent from one side of the river to the other?
Mr. Lockett,
Madam Chair and Representative, if one city elected to adopt a more stringent standard than the minimum, that could occur, that you would have a different requirement on one side of the river than the other. But the minimum standard is the same. So if the city elected to be more restrictive, then that's their choice, you could have that situation.
Madam Chair, just for curious minds, I will go on where my questioning is headed to. Some townships are going to be turning into cities, and they're very restrictive and protective of their river. But the city is less restrictive because they want more development. When they look at the property, they look at it as a development property. When the smaller city or the township looks at it, they look at it as, that's really a nice river and I want it protected. So there's a couple cases of townships really being fearful that when they're annexed, that they're not going to be governed by the state, but they're going to be governed by the city. That was what my question was about. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Commissioner... What?
Thank you.
If you heard opposition about coal tar banning coal tar?
Madam Chair, members, that's a pollution control agency issue, so I haven't heard any opposition at the DNR. So.
Okay. All right.
But I don't know if they'd be talking to us about it. So.
Okay. Commissioner, I have another one then for you. When you were talking with Representative Lilly and the other people who he was meeting with about the parks recommendations, how much were you thinking about using the money for acquisition rather than making parks better?
Madam Chair, members, if you look back to the governor's budget proposal that was presented back in beginning of session, we were really focusing on non-bondable capital type expenditures. Acquisition wasn't even included in there, I do not believe. We were focusing on more program type upgrades, for example, upgrading our campground systems, upgrading our trail systems. I think the governor's proposal falls pretty much in line with the bill that Representative Lilly is carrying right now. So we're supportive of that package.
And Commissioner Meyer, the reason I brought it up was because I was surprised by the way the discussion went last night from some of the people that testified, because I hadn't thought acquisition was a big thing either. But it did come out last night that in both Metro Parks and the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks discussions, that acquisitions seemed to be at the
one of the two front burners, if not the leading one. And I think we need more clarification from both, from all the groups on if that is going to be major. Also on operations, if there, the use of the money is going to be used for operations in more detail than what the governor was recommending, I would like to know about that, too, in the next few days.
Madam Chair, we can provide you that information. I think it's safe to say, and I think the committee has a good understanding, that the three systems are in different stages of development right now. The state park system probably has an advantage because we've been around for a lot longer. We do look at acquisition as very important, focusing on high priority in holdings within the state park system, because as these properties come up, usually it's a generational opportunity. A family member or a family is selling their property, and if we don't have an opportunity to acquire that land, it continues into private ownership, which creates an in-holding land use type of issue we have to try to deal with. But we also look at bonding funds and LCCMR funds and other sources of funding for acquisition as well. So it's a great opportunity for all of us to figure out how do these three funding sources blend together and what should the purposes be. Where should acquisition come from? But I think we also need to make sure that there's a level of flexibility out there, no matter where the funds come from, to deal with these issues as they do arise. And I think we're on a path to get there right now.
And the other question was that we didn't, when we talked about the state park part last night, we didn't talk very much about the state trails. And what could you tell us about your vision of how the parks and trails funding from the Parks and Trail Fund would be used for trails?
Madam Chair, I feel like you've thrown me a little softball here, so I'm going to take advantage of it. There's a couple things going on that we do really appreciate. One is the long-term strategic plan language that's in play. I think Representative Bouguinas has that in a different bill. But that is really critical for us to establish the glide path, if you want to call it, the where do all of these park systems fit in, and how do they interconnect with each other. And your line of thinking, Madam Chair, is exactly why we've recently merged the Parks and Trails divisions, because they do need to interconnect, because they are both so important, and we need to figure out where should those trails go to and what should they interconnect with. And the state parks and trails, it's a great opportunity. There are funding program activities within this bill to do trail rehabilitation, some upgrade signage and things like that, so we're looking forward to that. But also sitting down with all of the stakeholders and trying to figure out what is this system going to look like, what's the target we're aiming for, and then after we have that, figure out how do we get there in a systematic fashion. So some of it we have good ideas on, some of it we're trying to figure out what the answers are to that question that you have. But I think, you know, hopefully by next year we'll have a lot more of those long-range ideas down on paper so we can continue this move forward.
Because you're going to have that plan.
Exactly.
And who will be invited by the commissioner to help create that plan?
Madam Chair, I don't have the language in front of me. It is rather specific, but it will be the Department of Natural Resources in conjunction with representatives from the Metropolitan Regional Park System, the Greater Minnesota Park System, other stakeholders. I'm sure the Parks and Trails Council will have a large opportunity for participation. Other organizations, local units of government, nonprofit organizations. I envision it to be a holistic, open approach facilitated by the DNR to get us have a great discussion statewide. Actually, one of the things we're talking about is how do we take advantage of the media opportunities that are out there, the web, TV broadcasting and things like that, maybe working with Twin Cities Public Television in the end to hold some large form participation meetings. Certainly it's going to have a huge regional aspect to it as well, looking at the regions of the state, how do we interconnect Southwest, Northwest, Northeast, Central Minnesota, and taking everybody's considerations into play as we develop that plan for the statewide system, for our system, the citizen system. So it's a big process, but I think we can get it done very good, very successfully.
Park.
There'll be a lot of parks visited, a lot of trails visited. Not all state parks, not all regional parks, not all metro parks. So it'll be, you should hope for good weather, hopefully well.
I know, it's got to be a good summer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Guinness.
I think maybe I could help out a little bit with the question about accelerating facility maintenance and rehab in the DNR system, because we jotted down some figures to make sure that we could pay for all of the outcomes in Representative Lilly's bill. And it goes like this, upgrading at least 3% of the facilities in overnight and day use areas. That was $4 million. I think it's actually $4.5 million. Improving access to parks and trail systems for visitors of all levels of ability, $1 million. Enhancing the trail surface of at least 100 miles of trails, resurfacing 20 to 40 miles, repairing 6 to 10 bridges and replacing 2 to 4. That was $6 million. And then rehabbing and renewing trails in state parks for hiking, biking, horseback riding. It was another $1 million. So all together, $10 million of that was just in the up. Roughly $10 million was up, just in the upgrade. More than that, in the upgrade of current facilities.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Any other questions about parks and trails, Representative Lilly?
Madam Chair and members, to your kind of your first question about the allocation for operations and maintenance and some of the, you know, that kind of an acquisition, and just to kind of be clear that the state park portion does not use you know, it doesn't have the word operations or anything in there like that. It builds it's kind of creating connections to the outdoors is kind of the goals, accelerates resource management, deals with facility maintenance, very specific, though, on outcomes, which I think are goals that you have desired. And it simply doesn't just give the money to the DNR. I mean, there's very specific outcomes that that are set forth that Chair Wagenius just kind of mentioned. So I just wanted to throw that out there. It looks like, going to your other comment on the committee, and I like how you phrase that about on the commissioner, you know, as far as like this, I wonder if we should do that with the 10-year plan, too, with the language, you know, with, we have it, sounds like it's set more for the long-range plan, but maybe that needs an amendment here with the short-range plan as well. So it's not as clear as was stated, and I like how you said it. So
that the commissioner was going to facilitate this discussion.
Right, and then with the stakeholders, and then in your final addition to hold it in the state park, I thought was good. So
I didn't say state park.
Or a park. A park.
Yeah. Some of the areas of the state don't have state parks, and that's the whole point.
They're just SRAs.
That beautiful park.
SRAs, that's right. Or
I'd recommend that beautiful park in Duluth with the waterfall I saw. I'm not sure of the name, Madam Chair.
That could happen. But maybe there's better spots. Maybe it could be at the Swinging Bridge at Jay Cook. Or maybe it could be in my backfield. No, because too many people would come. No.
Just see
better not.
You could have Lily show up.
Any other questions? Carson Taylor, Representative Kahn, then Hanson.
Madam Chairman, just a question. This trail, well, I know Representative Lily, but does the trails also include water trails?
Madam Chair, members, that's an open question. It, at least in our opinion, it would, as we look at trail systems.
Water trails.
Madam Chair.
On the St. Louis. Yes. Who's?
Madam Chair.
Representative
I would hope that we certainly in a line point, you know, we talk about invasive species and different stuff with the waters of the state and the, you know, the state waterways. But clearly, that would be my vision. I mean, we could do a much better job, and again, yesterday, I don't believe you were here, but I handed out the Minnesota, what did you do with it? You added a little piece of artwork to it, but the travel guide, and, you know, much of that is kayaking and different things, the opportunities that are available around the state, and certainly we could do a much better job, like we're trying to do with snowshoeing and other areas, to and cross-country skiing to enhance water park use and as well. So thank you for the suggestion.
Representative Hansen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm him.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Meyer, I have a water question for you, not a parks question. So, on page 6 and 7 of the bill, we've had a lot of presentations about LIDAR, and I think since this was in the last committee, there were some news articles about outsourcing of the data, and prior to that, we had I had put some language in there about using existing staff, and I'm just wondering if that, if anything has changed, or if what's the department? You have to contract for a plane, but you have employees that could be doing some of this work.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, our position has not changed from the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee or anywhere along the way. The language that's in the bill states that we will use state employees, I believe, or Department of Natural Resources employees wherever possible, and it's our clear intent to do so. Actually, a great story to tell is as the flood was coming up in northern Minnesota, up in the northwest, we had our state DNR person who was actually digitizing this information as quickly as possible so that data could be used to set those flood bags and set flood preparation work as that was going on. And he worked over the weekend to make sure that work was digitized and available. He was one of our experts in the field, and he will be working on this as well. So we do understand the concerns that people have about the issues related to the project, and we'll do our best to deal with those situations as they come up.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Meyer, I was paying attention to this LIDAR, the new acronym for me. How does that fit in with the stuff with static limits?
Madam Chair, I'm not completely familiar with the status of LIMIC right now. The LIDAR, it's light imaging data resolution. What it is, they fly a plane, they take a laser, and they measure the distance, and then all that data is digitized so you get an accurate, super accurate digital elevation model of the topography of the state. So we'll do that statewide. The plan for this is that this would be housed within the Department of Natural Resources database on our website. I know there's some situations with LIMIC and the geographical geospatial data center that are going on. We can certainly work and figure out the best home for this and figure out where it should reside. We aren't.
This is being done separately from LIMIC then, and with no connection to LIMIC?
Madam Chair, members, Tim Lesh and our staff work very closely with LIMIC and the University of Minnesota, and it's a very tight-knit community that deal with that. I can get back to you, and we should discuss that and figure out where you want this to reside or where it should reside. We are not wed to this. We want to make sure it's at the best place possible, who will ever take the best care of the data and make it accessible for everybody.
And it's not just data for DNR's use.
No, this is
for many agencies' use, including the state archaeologists.
Madam Chair, this information will be used by all local units of government and citizens. It should be accessible to access that data for their needs.
Any other questions for Commissioner Meyer? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Metropolitan Council for the Parks. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Schellerud.
Steffarud.
Steffarud.
And, Madam Chair, I do have the information you requested last night regarding the staffing levels in each of the park agencies.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steffarud, last night, and thank you for bringing that information back. Last night, I have to say I was incredibly impressed with the work that Representative Lilly and others had done as far as outcomes and criteria went for the allocation of the resources to the statewide parks. And I guess today I would ask if you and others working with Metropolitan Regional Parks could come back to us sometime soon with perhaps not as much detail as Representative Lilly had. I have a feeling he's been working on that for a while. But some detail, some criteria, some outcomes so that we could have a little more specificity on how the Metropolitan Regional Parks plan to spend those resources.
Madam Chair and members, we have a handout that was brought to the committee last night titled Metropolitan Regional Park Implementing Agency's List of Projects from Parks and Trails Fund Appropriation, House File 1493, which answers your question, Representative Morgan, in great detail.
So you have to read. It was on our in our packet, yes.
And it's are you telling me that the exact projects, Mr.
Yes.
Steffarud, are in there and the cost for each one of them?
That's correct.
Based on the funding levels specified in the...
In the bill.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's very specific. I will take a look at that. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you. Any other questions for Metropolitan Parks? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
To Representative Morgan's question, it is it's amazingly specific, and the one... thing though, it doesn't. We didn't really set specific goals, but it's amazing when you look at the document how the a lot of it went to acquisition and very specific is like projects and outcomes. And so, please, if you don't have it, please make sure that we get it to you. So, thank you for the question, actually.
Mr. Becker. Representative Hollis isn't here now. Okay. The other day when we were talking about the outdoor heritage, we talked about the USFWS, United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And that's a federal agency.
Madam Chair, yes, it's an agency within the Department of Interior.
Okay. And Representative Howes asked when we were done with the project who would own the land. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Have you thought any more about the answers to his question?
Madam Chair, the way the program is currently set up, the United States government would own the land. As I understand, the request also of Representative Howes was to see if, with language, we could do something to improve that. I have not had time to work with your staff to get that done.
Okay. I think Representative Howes did work on it, and we do have an amendment that he can offer at a later time. But do you think about, was there any advantage to, or was there
how this came about. You had the ownership in the United States with the United States government. Is there an advantage to that?
Madam Chair, I can relate the history, which I think can help explain why it is what it is. And the history was with regard to lands owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that investment in those maintained the payment in lieu of taxes payments, but the state was not required to make those payments. The federal government was required to make those payments. So that was one advantage. The second advantage was one of long-term maintenance. The tails, so to speak, involved with federal ownership are not borne by the state. They're borne by the federal government. I think you can make of the argument, and a valid argument, that whichever way you do it, it's taxpayers who pay. But in the case of the federal government, you spread it across a larger base.
Okay. And Mr. Becker, Representative House picked it up right away because he's from the north, I think, and he's very smart. And but up north, this project where most of the land was going to be used for that project, most of the land was up north. And up north is where the federal government owns most land in Minnesota, right?
Madam Chair, my understanding of land ownership patterns in the state says that the answer to that question is yes, that's right.
Yes.
The north is where most of the federal land is.
And that's where people talk the most about the government ownership of land, whether it's state or federal. And so I think the sensitivity to that is why it came out. Mr. Becker, one more question, and that's about the USFWS, United States Federal Wildlife Service. That doesn't have anything to do with the state and fish and, or the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that that is correct, that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is a congressionally chartered 501c3 created by Congress. Now, when you say has nothing to do with it, that's a little difficult because there may be some interlocking directorate issues and things of that sort, where the Secretary of Interior of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service serves on the board of directors. I'm not certain about that. I have a faint memory of that.
Okay.
In many conversations.
Okay, so we have to have more clarification, I think, on that. But we do have, and thank you, Ms. Becker. Representative Guinea.
You might ask a question on the first question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You said that we were thinking of giving money to the federal government because of tails. Well, one of the tails that you would be talking about is restoration and long-term management. And I saw this, if I remember correctly, this was in a tall grass prairie region. But help me understand the level of restoration quality from the federal government versus the restoration quality for prairies in the DNR.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, as usual, you've come up with a great question. And I don't know the precise answer to that at this particular point in time. I am assured that the federal government in its prairie management hires qualified staff and that sort of thing, but I'm not personally familiar with the quality of their restorations in the northern tallgrass prairie. The southern reaches of the tallgrass prairie in Kansas and Oklahoma and that area of the United States, generally they're preserving existing prairie, and the management is standard management, burning and that sort of thing. There's very little in terms of restoration going on there. I would be more than happy to get the information for the committee in a short order, though. I think it's a great question.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Potts.
Thank you. On a very lower level, when people were giving me up or giving the city property that I was controlling, they wanted standards to be met on the quality control and what is going to be planted and how it's going to be maintained. And with that deed came those restrictions. And with their ability to audit to see if it was going to be used in the way that they wanted it to be taken care of. If we're going to be given property to the federal government, we shouldn't be hoping that that's what they're going to be doing in the future. We should be demanding that's what they're going to be doing in the future. I mean, this is a gift, and it should be a gift with hooks of maintenance. I just don't think we should give things away and then say, I wish you would. Because they're bigger than we are. And how would you force them? They don't have to obey any of our rules. The federal doesn't have to obey the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that reminder, too. And Mr. Becker, one more question. Last night, there was someone that came on the clean water bill to burn someone that came to talk about fish habitat and that we should be doing fish habitat in the clean water bill. Could you remind us of what's in the outdoor heritage part on fish habitat?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do my best. But let me begin by saying that clean water is important for good fish habitat, at least reasonably clean water. The restoration and enhancement of wetlands, grasslands, prairies, and forests in this bill all contribute to clean water. But I think that there's some particular projects in the bill that I'd like to bring to your attention that I would consider as being more directly associated with habitat for fish. And I'm going to go through the bill very quickly on page 4. There is the acquisition on the Rum River and Cedar Creek, which will maintain, restore, and enhance shoreline, vegetation, trees, overhangs, things of that sort. On page 5 is the Minnesota Forest for the Futures program, which is an extensive multi-watershed protection project. Page 9, there's the Aquatic Management Area acquisition. That recommendation is for $5.8 million. I believe it's the largest single appropriation, if it is appropriated, to the Aquatic Management Area program that's ever been done. I don't know of a larger one. Perhaps one of your members does, but I don't know of it. And then on the same page, the Coldwater River and Stream Restoration Protection and Enhancement will address streams throughout the state that support trout and salmonoids. And this is one of the particular fisheries resources in Minnesota that's under the utmost stress. And I might add, it is vital that we have good management of our watersheds and good spring recharge. And I don't mean spring as in the spring of the year, but spring is in water coming out of the ground and flowing through the ground, to maintain those resources. On page 10, there's Lake Rebecca Water Quality Improvement Project. Lake Rebecca is a premium muskie lake in the Twin Cities area. It's used for brood stock. In other words, that's where we get the input to the hatcheries to create the muskies that are stocked elsewhere to bring the muskie fishery back, if you're a positive person on that pursuit. And finally, down in the Albert Lea area is the Fountain Lake Fish Barriers, which is coupled with a water quality project to clean up some lakes in the Albert Lea area, keep rough fish out, and restore the quality of that fishery. I might add it's a fishery with extraordinarily close population proximity, as are some of the others I mentioned.
Thank
so
you
that
very
would
much.
Be the bill.
Thank you. Members, in your packet, there's an interesting idea that was slipped under my door about this creating, if we don't want to use the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation idea, we could consider the idea that was slipped under my door, just for your consideration. The Culture and Outdoor Resources Committee will convene again tomorrow at 8:30. This meeting is adjourned.